It's a Cab Chat interview.
Where you're hearing things. Where you're hearing things.
This episode is the second part of the John Mason interview, where John reveals the facts about the licensing of Uber. So I'm sure you'd be very interested to hear what he's got to say about that.
Getting back to private hire, John.
Yep.
What's your view on blacked out windows in private hire vehicles and obscuring the Roundel licence disc in the back window?
Yeah, I must admit, I looked at this one as well while I was there, and I know it was a source of much complaint. The regulations, and I hate to trot out the regulations, basically say that the tinted windows have to be a legal tint.
Yep.
And unfortunately, even with a legal tint, you know, even complying with Road Traffic Act or whatever it is, even with the tints that people were using, even though it might be legal, it did sometimes obscure the license. And yeah, and that's what actually we tried to make progress on through that private hire consultation, was to, you know, can we make the license an integral part of the number plate? Can we make it part of, you know, can it be stuck on the back, or so it has, you know, so it's not in the window? Of course, to actually issue an edict that you can't have tinted windows is a major decision that would require endorsement at the most highest level, because the impact on the minicab trade would be massive in terms of cost. And I said to you before, in order to make those kind of decisions, you need to have real hard evidence that the fact that tinted windows are putting people directly in danger.
Yeah.
You need some real hard evidence on that. You know, I can understand.
Isn't the amount of rapes occurring minicabs, obviously the blacked out windows,
you know, there's a map, you know, there's no doubt. I can't sit in front of you, Jamie, and say there isn't an issue, because there is. Everyone knows there's an issue, and there's not a week that goes by where there isn't some report of a serious assault in either, you know, nine times out of ten it's in unlicensed, and sometimes, yeah, it does happen in licensed vehicles. But you know, Does that give sufficient evidence? Does that provide sufficient evidence that by banning tinted windows you'd eradicate it? I don't think you would. Actually, there's more of a serious problem. There's an educational problem that people are still willing to put their lives at risk and their safety at risk by jumping into unlicensed vehicles. And you know, there was, you know, in not my defence personally, because it wasn't my responsibility, but in defence of TfL as an organisation, they did work really, really hard on the educational side, in terms of educating the public with the safer transport campaigns, you know, targeting advertising to the most vulnerable people. So, you know, girls going in, you know, a lot of the advertising was put on the back doors of toilets and ladies' toilets, and targeted at students and universities and things like that. But yeah, I'm not going to sit here and lie. You know, I go out into central London still, and I still see people willing to put their own safety at risk. And it's a problem that everyone needs to take really, really seriously. And, you know, I wish I was perhaps able to do more in my time to help, you know, reduce the problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, back to the issue of tinted windows. Yeah, there's different opinions. You know, yeah. If I was in the minicab trade now, I'd be saying, show me any evidence whatsoever that a licensed minicab with tinted windows has directly resulted in somebody being sexually assaulted. And I don't have that evidence. I've never seen any evidence to suggest that's the case. And actually, the real problem isn't actually tinted windows. It's people still willing to get into and put their safety. And actually, there is that other issue, of course, of lack of you know, lack of control, perhaps, or the, you know, of lack of some enforcement in terms of outside some of these venues.
Do you think there's enough enforcement officers?
Well, there's a million-dollar question. There can be never enough, I think. The size...
New York's got 15,000 taxis and 300 enforcement officers.
Do you know what? It's interesting, because it's not really a like-for-like, is it? Because the reason why there's so many enforcement officers in New York is they're able to, in an instant, because they've got the medallion system, where every medallion is worth about $1 million.
Yeah.
You know, when they announced a couple of years ago that they were increasing the number of officers, I think it was by about 100 or 600, maybe even as much as 500 officers. Yeah. I got on the phone to the New York, my opposite number in New York, and I said, how can you do this? And they said, well, what we did is we've just issued another 1,000 medallions. They got snapped up at $1 million each. That's $1 billion. We can fund it because we're able to sell these medallions. So they've got this income stream that just doesn't exist in London.
Yeah.
I know the police work really hard. I know that they try and make sure that the resource that they've got is targeted as much as possible. But again, this was another part of perhaps a frustration that I had in the role, was because of my role title, everyone believed, or a lot of people believed, I was directly responsible for deploying police resources. Now, you know, I went out with the police on plenty of occasions, you know, and we could be out walking. I remember one time in Shoreditch, we was out in Shoreditch. There was three officers dedicated to some undercover touting operation in the area. And we're stood on a street corner waiting for this female officer, undercover officer, to get touted, and then down the road a stabbing occurs. Now you have to understand that their priority switches from focusing on the touting offence to dealing with the stabbing. Now that's not brilliant news for the taxi trade. Because that means there's three officers out of however many deployed that are now taken away from, and you can never, I don't believe you'll ever be able to get the police to ring fence it so they would turn around and say, well, actually, no, we'll carry on doing our undercover operation on touting and someone else can deal with that stabbing. Yeah. They have to look and see where they're going to deploy that resources. And that was just in one location. I could imagine on a Friday night, if let's just say there's 50 enforcement officers out undercover doing undercover operations, I could imagine that happening quite a lot.
Yeah.
And when they do, if they do, they're not distracted and they do nick someone for touting, then 9 times out of 10, they're off the road then for about 2 hours completing paperwork.
Yeah.
So there is no, I don't think there is an answer to what is the definitive number of officers that would make a real dent to the problem.
Yeah.
And I don't think necessarily that it's just about officers. It's about proper enforcement of parking restrictions. It's about, as you say, being a lot more selective about where you issue satellite officers to. And it's that old age problem of rank space. And again, you know, I used to bang my head against a brick wall when it came to putting rank space in. And you know, I had every sympathy with the taxi trade. And trust me, I worked so hard to try and maximise the amount of rank space, but you can't build any more roads in London, and you're always competing, and more so as the years went on while I was in the job, with the demands of pedestrians and cyclists and bus users. And the cycling lobby is just as vocal and strong now these days, and perhaps even more so, given what they're getting in terms of the cycle superhighway. You know, they've got a massive influence in terms of what they've got and the amount of money that's been spent on cycling.
Yeah.
It was a constant struggle. So that, you know, you add all of those things together: satellite offices, resources on street, and road space availability, and it does seem like taxi drivers and the taxi trade are fighting an uphill battle to get what they want, and I can understand the frustrations of the people in the trade when they see some of these things happening.
Yeah. One question that's quite hot at the moment: Uber.
Ah, yes.
Uber. Obviously,
I've never used them.
their private hire operator's license was issued while you was still in position as
that's right,
LTPH.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people have criticised you for the issuing of the licence. Can you elaborate on that, John? I mean, I know we just had a quick chat about it.
I can understand again. You know, I'm the person in charge, so if something happens on my watch, so to speak, then ultimately I'm responsible. And you know, I haven't got sloppy shoulders in that respect. In fact, throughout my time, I took on a lot of responsibility for stuff that wasn't my responsibility to try and make sure that, you know, the job got done. But anyway, so Uber. I met Uber for the first time about a year before they were about to make a license, before they applied for a license. I only ever met them once, formally. At Palestra, there was a guy called Ryan Graves, came over from America, said, we're going to apply for a private hire operator's license, we've been through the regulations, and we're going to act fully within the law. I went, okay, well, that's good to know, because, you know, if you're going to do what you try to do in San Francisco and other areas in New York, then, you know, you that's not going to be good for you. For example, in San Francisco, the model was that they would use unlike drivers that had no license whatsoever.
Yeah.
So they said, no, absolutely, we're going to act completely within the law. We've been through the application. We've completed the application. We're going to submit it. And we are going to only use licensed private hire drivers in licensed vehicles. And we're going to act totally within the law. So I went, okay, well, if that's the case, submit your application. And that kind of is the end of my involvement. Because what happens then is, like any other private hire operator, the license application comes in, it gets passed to the private hire licensing team, they put all the details onto the computer, and then a file gets passed over to the compliance team, and they go out and they do what they call a pre-license inspection. So they go there to the office, the registered office that's on the application form, with a form, and they tick all the boxes or put crosses in the boxes and say, okay, you've either met the requirements of the application.
Yep.
And issue a license or recommend a license is issued, or they say, no, you haven't met all the requirements and the license is refused, and you can make a reapplication in due course if you can meet the standard that's required for the application. So I didn't get involved really after that. You know, they went through the process and they got their license, and of course they operate for they start to build up their operation and run the service. And you know, as at first, they just went on in the background and they started building up their business.
So basically what you're saying, John, is because they fulfilled all the requirements, LTPH had no option, but they had to license them because they couldn't have refused their license.
Well, pretty much, you know, it's like, you know, a good example would be, if I was a licensee of a pub or setting up a new bar or something, you know, and I want to apply for a liquor license, I go through the process, whatever that process is. You know, I should imagine there's an application, I have to have a premises, I have to have a CRB check, all those kind of things. You go through the process, and if you can tick all the boxes on the application that's laid down by law, you get the license or you get refused. Now, clearly my license, my liquor license is at risk if I then start serving booze to children, you know, 16 and 17 year olds. Because that's a breach of the law. And I guess what it comes down to now with Uber is, are they operating now as a private hire operator in the eyes of the law? So they got their application, but are they acting within the regulations in terms of all the requirements for keeping records? Is it a meter? Isn't it a meter? I know the taxi trade are very clear that they believe it's a meter. And I'm, I guess, quite fortunate that I have left now and I haven't been involved in those discussions. I'm pretty sure that there's been a huge amount of work done internally with TfL and their legal department and Queen's Council. I can't really make a comment as to whether I think they're breaking the law or not, because the only people who really know and can make that determination is TfL.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if they made a determination that Uber were acting outside of the licence and revoked that licence, then Uber would challenge it. And then it would go to court, and then some judge at some point would make a decision saying TfL were right or Uber were right. But I think one thing's for sure, Uber are here to stay. And even if, for example, this ruling that's going to the High Court, I understand, even if a judge was to say that is where I actually agree with the taxi trade representatives, and that's clearly a meter in the eyes of the law. Doesn't mean they lose their license. It just means Uber will turn around and say, okay, well, we won't use that anymore.
Yeah.
And they're still going to be here. Personally, for what it's worth, I actually don't think they've got a bit of a flawed model. I don't, they don't provide the service that the taxi trade do. They don't provide the customer service. They don't provide wheelchair accessible vehicles. And people want the service that the taxi trade do. I think the biggest threat Uber is, the biggest threat that there is, that Uber presents itself, is to the
private
hire trade, the Addison Lees of this world. Because, you know, take the customer service experience. You know, I see on Twitter all the time, normally retweeted by taxi drivers, but you see it on Twitter all the time. Passengers want somebody to take responsibility for the journey. And you know, if I get into a black cab, I know that if I make a complaint to the taxi driver and that taxi driver doesn't satisfy my complaint, that I can look at the number that's inside the cab, make a complaint to TfL, and they'll deal with it. But that's not the model that, you know, they've said they're a transportation company, and actually I think people want a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to be fobbed off and told to go and speak to the driver. They want somebody that's actually going to take responsibility for charging. I don't think this, you know, these things like, you know, a day like today, we're sat in the back of your cab in the rain, and
Uber surge pricing.
Yeah, there's going to be massive surge pricing. I haven't used it, and for the reason being is I want to get into a black cab, know that the driver's been through the knowledge. He knows the quickest way to take me from A to B, and I know that there's a quality of service there that perhaps I don't think exists with Uber. But I do think the taxi trade needs to embrace technology, and I think it has. You know, they have to actually know what Uber are doing. I don't think it's actually particularly groundbreaking. Yeah. You know, you guys were doing Ringo, years ago.
Dial a cab,
all these kind of things.
I know you can't comment on whether Uber should keep their license or whether they shouldn't keep their license, but in your experience from being director of LTPH, what is your opinion on e-hailing for minicabs?
Right, yeah.
Because, you know, Halo sort of an Uber set the model.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, actually? Because, I when I got the job back in September 2009, as was my, I believe, my responsibility, I started getting cabs a lot more, black cabs a lot more. And I did get minicabs, and I did sign up for the Addison Lee account very early on. I didn't get given one. I paid it all out of my own pocket. So I wasn't given, you know, I wasn't on any of these rumours that, you know, I was given a free Addison Lee cab account by John Griffin, and, you know, you can ignore all that because it's just not true. But so I downloaded the Addison Lee, and actually, so that was happening in 2009. To me, that was e-hailing.
Yeah.
Because I could book in advance for 6 o'clock, or I could say, now, I want one now. And if there was
Addison Lee, though, it actually goes through their computer system in the office. It doesn't connect you directly with the driver.
But then my understanding, and I could be wrong, is that's what happens with the Uber. That it still goes through a central
computer. Through a computer, but not through a booking system. So in effect, you still...
It's the same thing, though, James. I mean, I've been into Addison Lee's offices, and people booking through an app back in 2009, there was no manual intervention of that. There was no controller sat in front of a computer screen. Oh, there were, but for the telephone calls.
Yeah.
But for the app-based system, that worked pretty much in the same way that Uber does, which is, you know, somebody said they wanted a job, the computer system would find the closest person to that job and dispatch the job to it. I can understand the nervousness, concern, worry, all of those things that the taxi trade have got, that at the end of the day, black cabs should be the only things that should be hailed immediately. And that's in the law.
Yeah.
And technology, some of the technology that's emerging seems to be encroaching, well, not seems to be, is encroaching on that right. You know, you guys have gone through the knowledge, you've spent 2 years and a bit, you know. Yeah. I've met people that were studying the knowledge for 11 years. I think that was the longest, 11 years. But, you know, you've gone through that process. You have the checks, you have the most thorough background checks, vehicle checks, and that gives you the right. Gives you the right to respond to people hailing down vehicles. It gives you the right to taxis. Sorry, it gives you the right to drive in bus lanes. You know, it gives you the right to use the meter. And unfortunately, there is these emerging technologies that that are out there now that provide the public with alternatives. But I still believe that actually the public do want a black cab trade, and the politicians. And actually, you can survive. You can go on.
So my next question was, do you think the cab trade's got a future?
I do.
I ask everyone that question, so it's a statement.
I can say this from the outside now. I can say I think from quite an informed position that the knowledge process is untouchable. You know, I have never met a politician from any side that would even contemplate kind of tampering with the knowledge and removing the knowledge and you know, you perhaps underestimate the clout that you've got in terms of your influence. You perhaps underestimate how much you're respected and loved across the world. Perhaps you sometimes, as a trade, take things a little too personally, that you know, if Boris is spending £1 billion on bikes, he should be spending £1 billion on us. It doesn't really work like that, I'm afraid, because, you know, at the end of the day, you are sole traders. We don't tell you the hours you should work. We don't tell you the cost. You know, we don't at the moment, or TfL don't at the moment, force you to take credit cards or debit cards, although I personally think you should, although I heard there's talk that they might consider going down that route, which I don't think is the right thing to do. But the bottom line is you provide a service that I think is unmatched, and you certainly when you consider the accessibility of the vehicle, the quality of the driver, the experience that you've got, I think what is needed is for the trade to perhaps work collaboratively a little bit more. You use that influence as much as you can. I do think, and I might get shot down in flames for it, that, you know, I have got into the back of cabs and the driver clearly doesn't care about the presentation of his cab or himself or herself for that matter. Sometimes, but then I do think TfL have got responsibility there. That, you know, one of the things I would have liked to have done is there a way of doing a customer service element as part of the knowledge? Because I think there's too many drivers out there.
Courtney Connell's trying.
I think, you know, and I agree, you know, I've had clashes with Courtney about certain things, and I do agree on one thing, which is, you know, we have these people studying the knowledge for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, or longer, and yes, it does teach them the routes and the points and the quickest way from A to B, but it doesn't, in my view, teach them good customer service skills.
Yeah.
It doesn't teach them, you know, some of the benefits of using those skills and perhaps biting your lip and looking the other, you know, and being patient, and, you know. So I've had some bad experience in black cab drivers. I'm not going to lie, you know. Yeah. But the more the trade can come together and make sure that you maintain that standard quality of service that you are respected for and loved for, then you've got every chance of beating off the Ubers of this world, who apparently don't really see themselves as having any responsibility for the journey. Yeah. And please don't underestimate just how much. And I saw it just the other week down Cannon Street, where I'm working now, and this cab pulled up, and there was a lady there, and she was struggling with her buggy. And she had luggage. This guy jumped out of his cab, and he was coming along, and he was helping her out. He was helping her put the buggy into the back of the cab. And I'm sure that would have resonated with that woman, the experience and the quality of service. But you also sometimes see people that don't do that. And it doesn't. I don't think it takes much to make so much difference and to carry on making sure that people, the public out there, appreciate the service that you give is above and beyond what you would perhaps expect from your competitors. And the more you can do that, the more the trade can come together and make the standards and you know, but even pressurise TfL. You know, agree with each other that TfL want to bring in a customer service training as part of the knowledge without making the knowledge any longer. If you can do that, then I actually do think that's the right thing to do, because then it will make sure that you carry on delivering the service that you're loved for. So I had a friend just over 2 years ago who was leaving the bank, got his redundancy payment, and he asked me the same question: is there a future for the cab trade? And I looked him in the eye, and he's a really good mate of mine. I said, yeah, absolutely. I said, if you're willing to work. And I said, but the problem is, Tony, and he won't mind me name dropping. I said, you know, the problem is, Tony, is in order to make the money that you probably want to earn, you have to understand that you might have to work hours that you don't want to work.
Yeah.
You know that it is harder to earn a living, not just for taxi drivers, but for everybody.
Yeah.
And it means that you need to meet the demand. So when it's on a rainy Saturday night or early Sunday morning, you need to drag yourself out, and because that's where I think the earnings are. And he did his knowledge in 2 years, and I think he's out on the road now and doing well, because I knew he would. So it just needs to be considered in a round that, you know, you've got all this competition for cyclists, you know, you've got competition from cyclists now and pedestrians, and it's the job is undoubtedly going to be more challenging in the future, but there's still a future if you want it.
I know you've taken another job now, and you're not involved within the cab trade. Are you still going to keep a keen interest in the
cab trade? Well, I do, yeah. I mean, I follow you guys on Twitter. I download your podcast. I'm not sure I'll download this one, but I downloaded your one with Steve McNerney, which I thought was really interesting. I keep exchange emails with some of the, and texts with some of the cab trade reps that, you know, I had great dealings with. I get sent LTDA Taxi Magazine and LCDC Magazine and Mount View News, and so, you know, I like to you know I had great times. It was the most challenging point in my career. I perhaps in retrospect underestimated just how challenging it was going to be, but I still can sit here in front of you with conviction and say I'm pretty confident there was no one else in TFL at the time that could have taken on the job that I did, and all would have been willing to work as hard as I did to try and improve things. I had some successes, which I'm sure the trade won't deem a success, but they were successes for me because that's what I was being paid to do.
Yeah.
And there was some things that if I could go back and do my time again, then I'd perhaps do them differently. But above all, I do keep it in. I get into cabs. I got almost run over the other day. Again, down Cannon Street, and
this drivers recognise you.
Yeah, they do. And there's this guy. So this guy was coming. He's turning around a corner, and it was my fault. I was starting to cross the road, and he slowed down a bit, and the window was down, and he said, "Hello, sir. We need you back." But I'm not quite sure he was representative of the whole taxi trade that would welcome me back with open arms. But it was nice. It was nice. And when I get into cabs, sometimes you have that kind of 2 or 3 minute. They're looking in the mirror and where you're going, sir. And so I kind of tend to break the ice and say, all right, how's it going? He said, oh, I know you. And you know, I'm always, and I tried to do it while I was in the job. I was, you know, I didn't shy away from it. You know, as soon as I got back in the cab, I tried to very early on in any conversation explain who I was.
Yeah.
And Helen used to do the same. And we always used to give the drivers our cards and say, you know, if you've got any problems, give us a shout. Yeah. If you have any problems, because normally you'd get into a cab and they say, oh, I'm a bit worried about this, or this has happened, or sometimes you'd just be able to help.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard this rumour. that's how you used to start. I've heard this rumour, and you say, well, actually, it's not quite true. But, in answer to your question, I still have a lot of fondness for the trade, and generally, it was a really pleasurable experience. And, hopefully, people listening to this might have made up an opinion about me in the past might have a different opinion, but who knows, they might dislike me even more, you never know. So but if they see me in street and I flag them down, then you know I'm always happy to have a chat.
Well, thanks very much, John.
No worries,
thanks,
Danny,
for taking the time out.
No, thank you.
One question I want to ask you that I'm going to cut into the middle was private hire drivers.
Yep.
Do you think it's right that they don't have to take another driving test to assess their driving ability to convey passengers?
No, and I proposed that through the consultation we did. I said that there should be another standard of test. There's a standard DSA test. I think they're still called the driver mini. There's a private hire test that you can that exists, and other local authorities. I can't remember which ones in the UK demand that if you want a private hire license, you should do that, and you should do that test as part of the application process. But when we proposed that, it didn't go down too well because, again, as I said before, the minicab trade, the private hire trade, would actually prefer no regulation. You know, they don't want, they you know, constantly criticise that we didn't process applications quick enough, that we made people jump through too many hoops. And so on the one hand, you've got the taxi trade saying they don't go through enough hoops, and it's that old age problem where the private hire trade is saying, well, actually, you know, we don't, we think it's too onerous. In fact, I'll tell you, and this is a true story, one leading prominent member of the minicab industry said to me once that he felt that there shouldn't be any CRB checks on minicab drivers, which I thought was quite interesting.
I did read that somewhere, actually.
Mentioning no names, I'll let your listeners draw their own conclusions.
That was the second part of the John Mason interview. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got something out of it.
Cab Chat Radio Show is brought to you in association with Plan Insurance, who you can call on 0800 542 2869 or find them on the web at planinsurance.co.uk/cabchat. And DriverTax, who you can call on 0208 529 2600. You can also find them on the web at drivertax.co.uk.